This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking about Christian worship with a professor from a seminary in Chicago, Deborah Kapp. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, do you go by Deborah, Debbie? What do you prefer?
Deborah. Thank you.
Deborah. All right. And I'm Steve.
Okay.
You've had a book come out recently, and your very first chapter starts out, and the book also, next to the last chapter, ends with a discussion of a controversial church and a controversial pastor, Jeremiah Wright, who's been in the news a whole lot this year.
That's right.
When did you write this book? Was it before the current controversy?
Yes, actually, I was finishing editing it just as the controversy happened. So my editor and I talked about it, but these examples are, I think, pretty apt for what I'm trying to talk about, so I've left him in. Well, I would anyway. I think it's a wonderful church, and I think he's a strong pastor.
Now, you use Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago and its pastor, Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright, as a example of worship frames. Now, that's the way you use the word frames is in the sociological sense. Tell us a little bit about that for listeners who may not have that in their background.
Sure. A frame is a way of thinking. It's a mental scheme that helps us organize our experience. And the sociologist who started talking about frames most extensively was a man named Irving Goffman. And there have been a lot of people who've picked up from him since then. And frames can come in a lot of different ways, but Goffman would often talk about a theater the theater as a framing experience, where if you and I are going to go to a theater, we buy tickets and we go to a special place at a special time. Maybe we dress up, and at say 8 o'clock, we get into the building and the lights dim, and we take our seats, and the curtain opens, the orchestra plays, all that kind of stuff. All those actions that we take are part of the way the theater's framed, so that by the time we're in our seats and the play is beginning or the performance, then we know we're there. We know we're at the theater, and we know why we're there, and we have some expectation of what's going to happen. And then at the end of the play, assuming it's a play, the similar actions happen in reverse. The curtain closes, we leave our seats, we go back in our car, go home, and so on. So that the whole event is, in Goffman's language, framed by these series of actions that help us name what it is we've done. And they have... scholars have used the language of frames much in a variety of different ways, but that's probably a very good example of some of the things he was talking about. He also, and others, have talked about frames as being a way of talking about things, so that, for instance, the two sides of the abortion issue are framed differently. One is framed by talking about pro-choice, which is a language that brings up a whole set of values that have to do with women's reproductive freedom. And then the other side of the debate is framed by the phrase pro-life, and it brings up a whole different set of values that are coalesced around the value of the unborn. So those two sides are framed differently, partly by the language they use. And that's the other, I think, that framing as a way of organizing action and then framing as a way of finding a phrase or a language that can capture what it is you're about are two different ways that sociologists talk about framing anyway.
Now, when you and other religious scholars look at a Christian worship, Catholic, Protestant, mm-hmm. Orthodox, whatever, and use this kind of a lens to see it, this kind of a frame to frame it, what do you gain from that? What's your end product that you're looking for?
That's a really good question. When I was studying worship at first and began reading Goffman, when I got to this stuff about framing, it really helped me as a student of worship understand that some of the differences in worship experiences that I was feeling but wasn't able always to describe very well. And it was it helped me understand how the structure of worship shapes those different kinds of experience. I was studying traditional and contemporary worship, and those two are framed very differently. So I was really able to get a bigger picture and I think a more critical understanding. Critical, that is, in being able to analyze it, not sure. Being able to say something bad about it.
Right.
But I had a more analytical perspective when I was able to use this particular set of lens to think about worship and how it works.
So when you went to Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, this very large church pastored by Jeremiah Wright,
mm-hmm.
you were having a certain experience, there were certain emotions that were raised,
mm-hmm.
but it helped you to understand that, to interpret it by using this sociological framing way of understanding it. Tell us what you were feeling when you went to that church and how it differed from, say, the church you use in contrast to that in your first chapter, Lakeview.
It's both of them are wonderful churches, and I've visited Trinity mostly, well, almost exclusively as I teach D-Min students, and the students I've taken to Trinity are Korean pastors, and we take them to Trinity so they can have a particular kind of experience and see a particular kind of church. But we've been welcomed as a visiting class. But the what's overwhelming about going to Trinity is the energy and enthusiasm of the worship. It starts about 15 minutes or so, maybe longer, before the service begins. As people are coming in, they start singing, and it's a call and response singing like you find in a lot of African American churches. And it starts a little slow, but it gets very lively. They've got drums and I think an organ. I'm not sure about all the instrumentation they have. I shouldn't start listing it. And a song leader who's very good at getting people on their feet and singing. And they tend to sing songs that the congregation is fairly familiar with. The Korean pastors and I don't know them, but because it's call and response, it's easy to join in as a stranger and easy to join in if you don't know the music. And after about 15 minutes of singing, by the time you're done, the sanctuary is pretty full, and it seats, I think, about 2,000 people. So there are a lot of people there. Many of them are wearing African dress. And then everybody's on their feet, and the music is grand, and it's very energetic, and people look really happy. And then this choir enters, and the choir, sometimes it's a men's choir or a women's choir or a mixed choir, but it's huge. It's like 100 people. And they enter the sanctuary, and then they go sit up at the front, and the choir loft is like right at the back of the chancel, and they're seated in rows that are elevated, almost like stadium seating. And so these dozens of people filing in and taking their places, the choir, and then the ministers coming in as well, and all these people are dressed in African garb, and it's colorful, it's vivid, it's exciting. The first time I went to Trinity, when I left, I felt like I'd been to the gym. My blood was moving faster. I could feel those endorphins just going all the way through my body. It was great. And it's always been a positive experience for me. And I've heard a number of different preachers there, Wright as well as some others. But it's, as I say, always been very positive.
Let me say that toward the end of your book, in chapter 6, you say that before Jeremiah Wright went to be pastor at Trinity in Chicago, the congregation had adopted as a new motto, unashamedly black and unapologetically Christian.
Yes.
And you talk about how he expanded that that commitment to both of those throughout his preaching. And you quote from a collection of his sermons, so you were able to read his sermons as well as hear some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many of the recent reporters who loved playing a few clips of Wright's statements had ever read his book.
I don't know. If they did, they chose not to quote from that one. He's got several published collections of sermons. And most of them are available either through Amazon or through the church itself.
Judson Press, I see, published one of his, Good News, Sermons for Hope for Today's Families.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see where President-elect Obama certainly heard about the audacity of hope.
That's right.
Now, you contrast the feelings, the frame of establishes worship at Trinity with Lakeview. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Lakeview is a Presbyterian church and that's about six or seven blocks due east of Wrigley Field in Chicago. So any of your listeners who know where Wrigley Field is can figure out where Lakeview is.
Surely all of them do.
And it's a smaller congregation. It's got maybe 150 to 200 members. So on a Sunday morning, there'll be maybe 100 people there. It's a beautiful building. It's an old shingle-style church built by, I think the architect was John Root, so historically just a lovely space. And it's mostly a white congregation, although it's mixed, and it's mixed also in terms of ages and incomes and world perspectives. And it's a much more informal congregation than Trinity would be, and it's like a lot of Presbyterian churches. It's a little more reserved than the kind of worship you'd find at Trinity, but
only a little.
Well, a lot, but there's a real sense of authenticity and informality in the best sense, I think, when I worship at Lakeview. The pastor, it's not completely informal. The pastor wears a robe. They have a set order for worship, and it's pretty consistent week after week, and it's very Presbyterian in its order, but they've loosened it up a little bit in some different places. And the pastor's been there now almost 15 years, 10 or 15 years, and knows the congregation well, so it's possible to her comfort with the congregation really comes through in worship. So you get a real sense of, I don't quite know even the word I'm looking for, it's a church service that, it's a church that really knows who it is and it's comfortable in its skin. And that really comes through in worship. So the worship is, the congregation sings well, they sing all kinds of different things, they participate actively in the worship, but it's a real different church from Trinity in its style of worship and in its work. They share some of the same values, of course, but it's really quite different and distinctive, too, in its own way of being.
Now, you bring in a third congregation that has I guess you would call it contemporary worship.
Mm-hmm.
It's out with Southminster, and you talk in your second chapter about how framing defines action, and you talk about. I love the chart you had comparing the various what you call brackets between St. Luke's and Southminster. Could you talk about that and share that with our listeners a bit?
Sure.
And let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Professor Deborah Kapp, that's K-A-P-P, the author of Worship Frames, How We Shape and Interpret Our Experience of God, a book about worship. Professor Kapp is on the faculty of McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago.
You've asked about Southminster and its contemporary worship.
Yes.
And what I do in that portion of the book is compare the different actions that are bundled together at the beginning of their worship service and compared them to another church that established the frame. And I follow Goffman in referring to each of those actions as a bracket. And several brackets together would create at least one end of a frame. When I talked earlier about the theater, each of those things I mentioned that we do as we come to the theater, Goffman would call a bracket. So driving in our car to get to the theater, entering the building, buying a ticket, taking our seats, the lights dimming, all those things would be brackets. Well, worship services have the same thing. We come to church, a fair amount of small talk. We enter the sanctuary. We find a seat. Sometimes we're greeted formally by an usher or a greeter. The service opens with certain kinds of music, often. I guess it wouldn't have to. Certain styles of instrumentation usually characterize the worship service and so on. So what I looked at Southminster and its contemporary service were those kinds of things, what instrumentation they used, what songs they sang, what the particular order of worship was, and how what the logic of that was and how it brought people in and gathered them together for worship and helped them make that transition that all of us make when we worship between whatever our everyday life is, the busyness of a Sunday morning or the leisure of a Sunday morning, and then coming to this more formal setting for church. And then leaving again, too. There's a movement at the other end of the service as well.
And in terms of the distinctiveness about Southminster with their contemporary style is... you see them setting up the stage.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
People bringing in amplifiers and speakers and right. instruments and all of that.
Right.
Such a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At this church, the traditional worship service was at 9, and then the contemporary was at 11, and they couldn't leave the equipment up from week to week for the contemporary worship. So what would happen is after the traditional service would end at about 10 o'clock, these people would literally run down the side aisles because they wanted to get the huge screen up. And it was quite a production. It took 4 or 5 people, and they had all the equipment was behind the chancel, and they'd get it all out and get it up. And they managed to get everything pulled together in about 10 minutes. We could put a screen up, hooked up all the microphones, brought the music stands out, set up a soundboard, and then they rehearsed.
But you point out that all sort of sets up the expectation of the people that there's going to be something exciting happening, something very spontaneous and,
mm-hmm.
and current,
mm-hmm.
and reminds some people of setting up for a rock show or something.
Oh, it does. Sure, yeah. Sure. And it also highlights the differences between the two services, I think, because
sure.
especially when it happens back-to-back like that, because clearly they're using a different set of equipment, a different set of instruments, a different stage set, if I can, I shouldn't use that.
Arrangement of worship furniture.
Right, yes. There you go. And but it is very different. The more traditional service in a Presbyterian setting, and then the contemporary service. And in this church, they highlighted the differences because they wanted to give their people two distinct alternatives. So their traditional service was I suspect became much more formal to set it apart from the contemporary service, and the contemporary service was then much more informal and, of course, had the praise and worship music and the soloists instead of a choir and things like that.
Let me encourage listeners to join this conversation. This is a live call-in show every Sunday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. here at WILL from the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. If you would like to call us, if you're calling from the Champaign-Urbana area, call 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, perhaps you're listening on the Internet, anywhere around the country, 1-800-222-9455 will let you call toll-free to the station and to our guest, Professor Deborah Kapp, K-A-P-P, author of Worship Frames, a new book published just this year by the Alban Publishing Company, Alban Institute, that's spelled A-L-B-A-N. I'll ask Professor Kapp about that a little bit later. But we do encourage listeners to join in the conversation. Perhaps you've had an experience that these sociological terms might have helped you understand a little bit that Professor Kapp is talking about. Or perhaps you've just had an experience with worship in a contemporary setting or traditional that you might like to share. We'll be getting some more details in her book as we go along, but we're happy to have listeners call in with comments or questions. You talk about the individual experience of worship, but you get very quickly in your new book into the corporate aspect of worship, mm-hmm. of Christianity, the community, the congregation. Talk a little bit about how framing helps understand that.
Understand the congregation, you
yeah,
mean? Or?
Your chapter, let's see, I guess beginning on page about 51, you talk about how framing shapes a community. Tell us how that occurs.
Right. Well, when I talk about framing in primarily two ways in this book. One is these series of actions that basically comprise the first 10 or 15 minutes of worship and the last 5 or 10 minutes of worship, so actions on either end of the service as frames. And then I talk about the more discursive framing that goes on in some elements of worship, but primarily in preaching, as pastors talk about help a congregation get a sense of who it is over the course of their preaching over weeks and months and years. So for one of the things that frames do, these series of brackets, the structure of worship at the beginning, is to help pull people into worship and help them gather together into, from all the individual places we come, into a group that's doing things together and has a sense of its own togetherness. So, and that's what I mean by talking about framing builds belonging. It helps us become part of it helps us as individual worshipers really become part of that congregation, whether it's for one worship service as a visitor or for a larger experience that accrues over the course of our membership or our participation. And it does that in a couple ways. One is that we simply become part of the whole as we go through the physical actions of worship. We sing in company with the other people around us. We repeat, we maybe read prayers together, or we repeat the Lord's Prayer together. As we do things in unison, we are acting as a whole, not just as single individuals. So that's part of what happens.
Some of the people this morning might have sung, "We gather together."
That's right, exactly. And use the plural language. Mm-hmm. We didn't sing that one, but we sang similar ones. "Now thank we all our God," and
yes,
things like that. It's so the we-ness is part of what happens, just the physicality of it, but also theologically we're making those claims as well, as you point out. We're using plural language. We are bringing ourselves together in the presence of God and in the presence of one another as a group, not just as individuals. And what I'm hoping to do is help pastors think about that groupness, that the power that worship has to shape not just our individual experiences, but the corporate experiences as well.
Now, your new book, Worship Frames, also talks not only about what congregations, how they gather, how they feel, how they congregate, but also what they do. And you have a chapter on vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you refer to a priest at St. Sabina. Is it Father Flager? Is that
Flager?
Flager.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about him and that congregation and their focus on justice.
It's an amazing congregation. It's a Roman Catholic congregation on the southwest side of Chicago. And Father Flager's been with them for a couple decades now. And it's a poor and community that's had a lot of violence and disruption. And that church has made a conscious effort to take responsibility for the community and to take responsibility to improve the community and to keep people as safe as they can and to make their corner of the world healthier. And one of the things I talk about is the work that Flager did back in the 90s to try and get his congregation to take action to get rid of some of the drug and alcohol trafficking that was occurring in the community. And they would do these drug marches every Friday night and in the summer, in the nicer weather. And he often preached about it and encouraged people to get out to participate in these drug marches and talked about the importance of people being doers of the word and not just hearers of the word, using that section from James. And I actually rely on Jim Cavendish's study of St. Sabina as I talk about this. He's published this in a book called, I can't remember the name of the book, Christian Clergy, I think. I'll get it in a minute. He points out the way that Flager's preaching over the years has helped the congregation really get a sense of its call to reform the neighborhood, but also helped members get a sense of what it meant to be a member there. To be a member there really means to be active. It means to be committed to the betterment of the neighborhood and the parish and to the betterment of the world. And he really works hard on that.
And then you also mentioned a church where you were on the staff for a while, a fourth Presbyterian in Chicago, and you refer to Elam Davies.
Yes.
In terms of how he was able to get a very different congregation from St. Sabina,
mm-hmm.
also to see their work, their vocation, what they did as... Tell us his famous phrase.
Yes, but Elam used to always talk about that our call to minister to the least, the last, and the lost. Although sometimes he said lonely, but the alliteration of the L's was frequent, and he talked about that a lot. He was the pastor at Forth when I joined the staff there in 1981, and I asked him. I remember in the interview asking him what he had hoped to accomplish as the pastor at Forth. And he said, oh, that's easy. He said, I wanted to change it from being a country club to a church.
Huh.
And he set out early in his ministry to establish social service ministries that had been largely absent in the church. The church had done wonderful things under its previous ministers, but he wanted to add this particular thing in the 60s and the 70s. And was very deliberate in helping the congregation think about itself in a new way, not just as the church it had been, but a church that could also be involved in these new ways in the neighborhood with county jail visitation, visitation at the county hospital, the setting up tutoring programs, setting up a program for older adults, and so on. And a lot of those ministries are still going today.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with that congregation, it sits right on Michigan Avenue, North Michigan Avenue in Chicago, right across from Water Tower Place, shopping mall, right across the street from, which hotel is it, Four Seasons? I forget.
One of them. Yeah,
and,
there are four
or five. and all of the Gold Coast stores. So it's set in a... very much a Gold Coast Chicago setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Reverend Davies to, over his, 25 years? How long was he pastor there?
23 years or something like that.
Because I know when I was in seminary in the 60s, between 65 and 69 in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
he was one of my two preaching professors. So
mm-hmm.
it was fascinating hearing him talk about preaching
mm-hmm.
and then going, of course, occasionally to Forth to hear him preach.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, the other preaching professor I had in those years was John Fry, who you also mentioned in your book.
Yeah, well, you were pretty lucky.
And I really was.
Mm-hmm.
Fry was in a very different church, and I want to get to that in a minute. But we're about halfway through our program. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Professor Deborah Kapp, K-A-P-P, who is the Campbell Professor of Urban Ministry at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. She is herself an ordained Presbyterian minister and has served several congregations herself in different places. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Her recent book, out just this year from the Alban Institute, is called Worship Frames, How We Shape and Interpret Our Experience of God. And we're talking with Professor Kapp about some of the ideas in her book, and we welcome people to join us in our conversation. 333-9455 is the phone number here in the WILL radio station. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Next week, I'll be interviewing another seminary professor, this time from Harvard Divinity School, Professor Matthew Bolton. He has a new book out called God Against Religion, also on dealing with worship issues. And it'll be very interesting to have these two programs back-to-back from Chicago and from Boston. We're talking with Professor Kapp by phone, and we'll be talking with Professor Bolton by phone. On December 7th, our guest on Keeping the Faith will be Mark Rivera, who is an undergraduate student here at the University of Illinois, and he's involved in the student newspaper. We're going to talk about what some of the values are currently that student newspapers reflect. The Daily Illini is the paper Mark is involved with. On December 14th, Bob Cathy will be our guest, another professor from Chicago, talking about Jewish-Christian dialogue. December 21st, Clyde Edgerton, the novelist, will be talking about his most recent, wonderfully funny novel, The Bible Salesman. That's December 21st here on Keeping the Faith. You're listening, of course, to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Deborah Kapp. Deborah, I mentioned John Fry was the other professor I had when I was a seminary student in Chicago in the 60s. He was pastor of a very interesting church. Tell us about it.
First Presbyterian Church is in the Woodlawn section of Chicago, which is a section that's gone through a lot of demographic change in the last 50 years, and probably some before that as well.
Far south side, 64th Street.
Right. And it's actually, a lot of that's documented. William Julius Wilson and the folks at the University of Chicago have studied Woodlawn a lot. So a book like Wilson's book, When Work Disappears, really talks about Woodlawn and its changes. But the, in the 60s, or in the 50s and 60s, when Fry was a minister there, the neighborhood had undergone dramatic changes. It had shifted very quickly from a black neighborhood to a white neighborhood, or white neighborhood to a black neighborhood, and the congregation was trying to figure out how to respond. They had once before moved, they'd moved several times in their history, and sometimes they'd moved to stay in a white neighborhood, but they decided they didn't want to do that again. They wanted to stay in Woodlawn, and they wanted to minister to that neighborhood, and they wanted to become an interracial church, and they tried very hard to do that. And one of the moves they made was to invite, become one of four congregations that invited Saul Alinsky of the Industrial Areas Foundation to come work with them to establish a community organizing effort in Woodlawn to help the community. And First Presbyterian was one of the several churches that was involved in that. It was a Catholic church, and they quickly also got involved with the Apostolic Church of God in the neighborhood and so on. And so the congregation with the community organizing model became much more confrontational with the powers that be. And at that time, the powers they were confronting were the University of Chicago. They were trying to, the Woodlawn Organization, which was the name of the community organizing group.
Or TWO.
Yes. Was trying to keep the university out of Woodlawn. They were trying to expand south. And they were also trying to, or at least the people at First Presbyterian were trying to work with the gangs in the area, the Blackstone Rangers being the most prominent gang, and trying to keep the violence down and listen to what people were telling them. And they got into all kinds of trouble. They were, the mayor was after them. Fry was investigated by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and it was really very complicated. But he was a brilliant preacher and wrote, preached obviously regularly because he was the church's pastor, but also published a series of sermons in a book called Fire and Blackstone. And I look at some of those sermons to look at how he framed the congregation's vocation as it was trying to shift its ministry in its particular location. And he it was interesting to see in this collection of sermons anyway, the way he used a lot of some of the Bible's more confrontational sermons to talk about the work of the church and so on. But the sermons are also good because they don't just they push the church too. They push the church and its members to be better and to think about themselves and their own ministries and their own failings in the light of the scriptures. They're very responsible sermons in many ways.
I think it was in 1967, maybe 68, when I was still a seminary student myself in Chicago, but I was invited to preach my first sermon outside of seminary. I had taken some preaching classes, but I was invited to preach at the Methodist Church here in Urbana, the First Methodist Church, because my wife and I had been active in the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago during those years with John mm-hmm. Fry and with all of the national furor about this church that was being accused of helping gangs
right.
rather than trying to oppose the violence. My first sermon was about the Blackstone Rangers and the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago, mission with them or to them,
mm-hmm.
trying to change that neighborhood for the better. So it's when I came across that chapter in your book, my heart was strangely warmed.
Well, it's a wonderful part of their story, and it's they paid a price for it.
Yes, they did.
They really were trying to do what they thought God wanted them to do.
And it wasn't until almost maybe a decade later that with the Freedom of Information Act, finally, John Fry was cleared of any wrongdoing, finally. But, of course, by then he'd suffered terribly, as had the church, from being accused of some pretty horrible things.
Yes.
But to get back to your use of how his sermons pushed people to action.
Mm-hmm.
I heard many, many of them over those 3 or 4 years when my wife and I were there, and we were certainly stirred to do something, not just to listen, not just to be passive.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was, I think, really working hard on it, from what I understand, and but also. Really, they were. What I'm struck with some of those sermons that they're also so gentle with the people.
Yeah, that's true.
So he's pushing them on the one hand, but on the other hand, you can tell how much he cares for them, and really cherishes them in a lot of ways. They stand up very well over time, I think.
His book was Fire and Blackstone. Whether it's still available, I don't know, but it's well worth searching for in old bookstores, if nowhere else, or libraries. We're talking about your book, Worship Frames, and in Chapter 7, you share a bit of your own experience with how to strengthen a congregation. You refer to your experience in Hartford, Connecticut. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I've pastored a church in Hartford. I was the solo pastor, and our congregation was about 200 members, and we had any place between 70 and 90 people in worship on a given week. 90 was a really good week, and it was a great church. But we had a very set order for worship, and we had a choir and an organist and so on. And in the summer, the choir would take the summer off, which was perfectly all right. They needed a break, and they were wonderful volunteers. But what happened was worship was really hard when the choir wasn't there, because we relied on the choir for the choral introit, which was part of what opened the service, and the procession, which began the service, and support in singing. The congregation was fairly elderly, and they weren't singers. It was just not a congregation that enjoyed singing much at all. So worship in the summer was really flat, and I just could not, I could feel it, but I couldn't think about it strategically. This is another reason I like this framing idea, because the framing idea helps me think about it more strategically. And if I were to do it over again, I would look at what we'd lost and figure out how to rework the summer so that it wouldn't be so flat. So the one thing we did was add a response at the beginning of worship in the summer, where the whole congregation, instead of a choral introit, would simply sing the first verse of Holy, Holy, Holy. And that gave us a way to have more music at the start.
And a song they all knew.
It was a song they all knew. In the 1920s, that was their opening song for worship every single week. At least that's what they told me. So, and there were members in that church who'd grown up in the church, so they remembered singing this as kids every week. So to be able to sing the verse of it in the summer really fit. It was a nice fit with the congregation, and it helped to sort of rebuild the frame, which was so thin without the choir's presence in the summer.
Thank you for sharing that example. We have a caller on line one, and let me encourage others to give us a call as well. The numbers are 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Line number one. Yes, you're on the air with Professor Deborah Kapp.
Yes, good evening. This is a bit of a digression, but you were talking about calls to action, and I sort of wanted to note the multi-religious faith and secular action that happened down at Fort Benning this weekend that hasn't been much reported in the regular news, so I thought it should probably wouldn't hurt to get a mention of it in here, because it's not entirely a faith-based action, but it's founded by Father Roy Bourgeois, who, curiously enough, the Catholic Church is threatening with excommunication this very week, because he signed on to a letter calling for the ordination of women in the Catholic Church. So I just, between that and the fact that it is such a multi-faith effort, and I'm sure there are some people from the community here that are actually down there, because there generally have been, I thought it was worthy of note, and I don't know if you really...
Yes, tell us about it.
Comment? Well, it's the School of Americas is a Spanish language instructional institute that...
It has a new name now. But,
yeah, it's called Hemispheric HIPIC or something like that. It almost was... there was a bill against it that failed by 6 votes, and I understand that 35 of the people that in the House that voted against it or lost their seats. I don't know exactly who replaced them, but it seems like the next year might be a celebration of the end of it. There are many people implicated. Roy Bourgeois was radicalized partially from being in Latin America and Central America, but also he was called to action when some graduates of this institute killed the Maranol nuns in Central America during the Central American War. I think it was in El Salvador in the mid-80s. So he's been working at it all these years. And again, I think it's such an affront that to his project that the church picks a fight with him at this very week. But I don't know. I think it's an exceptionally good project. And again, it's many of the people down there this weekend are faith-based. There were 6 arrested as of the mid-afternoon for nonviolent protest and crossing into the base. And they read the names of the disappeared and dead that can be attributed to graduates of the School of Americas there. It used to be in Panama before, but that's a long history. My voice is actually failing from a mild ailment. I wish you all good health.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that event.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. We're back with our guest by phone. Can you still hear me, Professor Kapp?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Okay, great. Any comments on that report?
No, I was grateful to hear it, though. It's some of our students were down there, and we helped frame their departure by praying for them before they left, and I was glad that McCormick was represented.
Tell us about your own personal history, how you came to be a professor in a seminary.
Oh, it was really one of those happy... I was really lucky, I think. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church and sailed off to college in the late 60s, early 70s. And
where did you go?
I went to Brown University, and I majored in religious studies, but never, ever thought I would do professional religious leadership. And my mother kept saying, well, what are you going to do with a degree in religious studies? And I didn't know. And then I found my way to seminary. I went to Union Seminary in New York City, largely because I thought that was a seminary that would not train me to do parish ministry, because I was sure that that was what I did not want to do. But then by the time I graduated, I was sure it was what I wanted to do and had found my way to some good training in the meantime at Union, and ended up in my first call in the church in New Jersey at Central Presbyterian Church as basically an interim assistant pastor, and was there for 2 years. And then we moved to Pittsburgh, where I served the denomination with the Women's Program Office. It was a regional office, and I worked with women in a 5-state area. And this was the Presbyterian women, the women who are active in mission and volunteering and altar guilds and things like that, circles, Bible studies. And then we moved to Chicago with my husband's job in 1980, and I was fortunate to get a job at Fourth Presbyterian Church as an associate pastor, and I was there for 10 years, and then decided it was time to be out on my own, and that's when we moved to Hartford, and I was there for a couple years as the pastor at that church. And then I heard about an opportunity to come to McCormick, and the stars just fell into place, I guess, and was able to join this faculty in 1995. And then I did my advanced degree work after that in sociology. I wanted to train for congregational studies and finding ways to help ministers think in a different way about their congregations and their leadership. So I went in that direction.
And where was that degree?
At Loyola University in Chicago. And I ended up in sociology because that's where a lot of the congregational scholars are, interestingly enough. And when we were in Hartford, I was very much helped by people at the seminary. There's a seminary in Hartford, Hartford Seminary. And it's one of the places where there were a collection of folks who were doing congregational studies and producing materials that I found very helpful as a local pastor. So I was kind of following their lead and hoping to help other people the way they had helped me.
And tell us what you teach at the seminary.
I teach in two primary areas. I teach leadership studies in the Doctor of Ministry program and also in our master's program, and teach a variety of courses around that. And then I also teach in our urban ministry program and am currently in the urban ministry chair, as you mentioned earlier.
And some people may not know how seminaries are organized. They are graduate schools, so people who come there have already received a college education. Seminaries these days in this country are very diverse. You mentioned a group of Koreans you were taking to an African-American church. Tell us about the diversity of the seminaries.
Well, you're right. They are very diverse. And it's interesting because in the all denominations have had a different approach to theological education over the years. Some denominations have not required graduate school from their ministers, and others have. But more and more, even denominations that historically haven't required master's degrees are now asking for that. So we have more and more people interested in seminary and from a variety of different social locations. So McCormick is a Presbyterian school, and we still get a lot of Presbyterians coming to McCormick. But we also have students of a Pentecostal background, a Baptist background. We have several students who are members of Trinity UCC. We have students who are, and a few who are Lutheran or Covenant Evangelical or Episcopalian, something like that. But mostly Presbyterians, Baptists, and Pentecostals. So that makes for a very lively classroom, as does the fact that we come from a variety of different cultural and racial backgrounds. We at McCormick have programs for Asian Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans, and Euro Americans. So we have all of us in the classroom together.
And what comes out of that mix?
Well, a lot of different perspectives. And one of the things I run into in my classes is different attitudes about how much authority a pastor should have. So some of the people in my classes will argue strongly for a more horizontal authority structure in congregations. But others come out of traditions where the pastor really lays down the law, and you do what he or she says, mostly he in these cases. And they're comfortable with that, and that makes sense in their churches, and it works. So it's really interesting to talk about issues of authority and power and who makes decisions, because there's no one way that you can tell people they should do it.
35 years ago when I was in seminary, maybe it's 40 now, almost everyone was young, right out of college. It's very different now, and you also have many more part-time people as well as international students.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And that and these part-time people are most of them working full-time and trying to go to school. So it's really hard for them to find classes and figure out how to make it work, but they do. They work really, really hard.
What gives you the most satisfaction as a professor in a seminary?
That's a good question. I think what gives me the most satisfaction is seeing a student really appreciate something that we're doing in class and figure out a way to use it in his or her ministry. And I feel that I first saw that happen in Doctor of Ministry classes, but it happens in the master's classes as well. And I also find it very satisfying to learn new things myself, and I'm always learning new things, whether it's from the students who come from church locations that are way different from mine, or visiting these new churches that I've never visited before, or reading a new book. It's great to be able to be in a place where I learn so much.
We'll need to come to a close at this point because we're nearing the end of our time. We've been talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Deborah Kapp, Campbell Professor of Urban Ministry at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church who's had experience in serving churches as pastor, as well as now being a professor for how many years?
13.
13 years.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being on our program, and thanks for the listener who called in with a very good comment about Christianity in the news these days. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I might mention that I'll be teaching a course here in the Champaign-Urbana area at the University of Illinois next semester as part of the OLLI program, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute here at the University of Illinois. They have quite a number of classes that are available for people who are 50 and above, retired. I'm teaching one on Islam, Multiple Perspectives. So if you're curious about Muslims and the religion of Islam, I'll be teaching that course starting January 27th. It's on a Tuesday afternoon from 3:30 to 5. It goes for 8 weeks. And if you're a member of OLLI, it's just $25 for that course. And we'll be having many people from the local university and Champaign-Urbana area who worship at the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center here in Urbana as our guests who will be sharing their religious experience. So if you're interested in that, do check with online at OLLI, and you can find out more about that or give the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute a phone call. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, my guest will be Professor Matthew Bolton from Harvard Divinity School, talking about his new book, God Against Religion, also dealing with Christian worship. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Space, the final frontier. But is science fiction the final frontier when it comes to being a literature of ideas? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll wax philosophical about science fiction with two of the genre's greatest writers, George R.R. Martin and Ursula K. Le Guin. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7.
This is WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS. presenting the host of This American Life, Ira Glass, in an evening entitled Radio Stories and Other Stories on Saturday, December 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets available at 217-206-